came off wrong.
How do you spell Weir?
W-E-I-R. Morton Weir. He's now the chancellor of the Vatican. Should have been the chancellor of that. Politics of that system, much like the pond politics, didn't let him become chancellor. This guy from Irvine, whatever. The council vote, and the vote was, I think, either 7-1 with an abstention or 8-1 for pond, with Anderson being the only one who voted against pond. And Anderson voted for Mike Hammond, who already had withdrawn. But nobody on the council knew that but Anderson. The council sent, now, the faculty senate, or whatever they called it there, I'm not even sure of the governor's picture, had not even interviewed Alan. And basically said they would not find him an acceptable candidate. In fact, the search process didn't ask them to interview Alan. There was the normal opposition from the student government. I mean, you know, you could predict who would be opposed. There were good reasons to be opposed. I mean, I want to be clear here. But the process was stacked in a way that no one quite understood. The council sent this nomination forward. Anderson had been trapped. He thought it would have been headed off. He'd had this conversation, so and so forth. The trustees turned it down. And either the council asked for or the trustees invited them to a meeting in Albany to meet with them. So about 6 or 7 council members went up. Sam Easterbrook, term expired just about that time, so he was now off the council. The one who could have made the most effective case, a member of the search committee. They went up there, and I'm trying to think of the guy's name, something Warren, who was vice chair of the trustees. Yeah. Bald guy. Okay.
I've interviewed him.
Okay, right. And I have to digress again here, but before Johnny had left, as this debate had been going on about where was the future of students, Johnny happened to be in Albany the day that a guy named Jim Kelly, who was then acting chancellor, had come from Georgetown. This was after Ernie had left, as executive vice chancellor. Very bright, tough, political guy. Probably a good guy. I don't know. Certainly not from the perspective I had from Stony Brook, but probably a competent guy. He was testifying before the assembly, higher ed or ways means to me, and flat out said to them that the future development was going to be 2/3 of Buffalo and the rest of the United States. That was the first time that we had ever actually had numbers put on the table by SUNY. They had always said, oh, we'll take care of you, we'll take care of you, you're in, you're in, you're in. We had always doubted it. The people in the lower levels who were giving us accurate information were saying you're getting screwed, and so on. So Kelly went and testified. Johnny, outraged. He happened to be there, heard it, and went, you know, I mean, he'd been absolutely lied to. Threatened to quit on the spot. Ended up with a meeting with then Irwin Landis, who was chairman of the Higher Education Committee Assembly on Long Island. Johnny, whatever you do, don't quit. Let's talk about this. Get this resolved. But all of this was in the background of what Alec understood, what Johnny understood, what the ball game was, because they were dividing up several hundred million dollars, and it was clear 2/3 was going to go to Buffalo, and the rest was going elsewhere. That, if that's the case, you did not have the Stony Brook according to the way we had always thought of it. That was the issue. That was plain and simple the issue. Bricks and mortar were driving programs. Bricks and mortar decisions were going to drive programs. You couldn't have a comprehensive power in the fine arts and the humanities and the social sciences without the facilities for them. That's what was at, that was what was in the Stony Brook program that was not now going to be funded. We have the meeting with the trustees. And at that meeting, Warren, I keep saying Mike Warren, that's not his name. The chairman wasn't there, Blinken wasn't there, and Anderson wasn't there. He absented himself from the meeting, refused to go on. He was a dagger for the rest of the council. Warren said, but we told you at the beginning we would never accept Alec Pond as a candidate. You knew that from the start. But they didn't know that from the start. Peter Papadakis practically came across the table at the time. He was outraged. He said, what do you mean? We never knew this. You mean we have gone through a search for whatever number of months, and these guys had spent a lot of time, I don't think they did a good search because they got out of them in some sense, but they had gone through the search process, meeting after meeting, all these interviews, views, and whatever else. And it was now at the 99th hour they discovered that the council had been told that they could never accept Pond. Pond never knew that. I think Alec never would have let himself get in the box had he known that. But he was in track. They left that meeting absolutely. They resubmitted his name. There was pressure on the new Democratic members who were new and didn't know what the hell was going on, that this is a Republican issue. So they weren't exactly the new Democratic members of the council. They didn't really quite know what to do. But the votes essentially were still very much the same. The trustees then turned it down again. Now this was the only time the trustees had ever turned down a recommendation from the council. Only time since, only time. It was at a meeting at Cooperstown. Sydney and Alec and I went to the meeting. The press was there.
The meeting of the trustees?
The trustees was at Cooperstown.
Of the university. Yeah.
They turned Alec down. Van Arsdale voted for him. It was one of the rare times in SUNY's history of trustees that they didn't have a unanimous vote on issues. I mean, they were, the decisions get made by the president. There were at least two other people who were fairly close were going to vote against the trustee position. I mean, this was a really big thing. Van Arsdale had gotten word from the Long Island Labor Committee, this is a screw job, basically. He did their vote instead. In fact, I think one other person, Nan Johnson of Rochester, may have too. I'm not sure of that. But anyway, Alec was then turned down. He's a very private person. This was enormously difficult for him anyway. The fact that it was set up from the beginning never to happen was another issue, again, something. And I don't think he ever would have let himself get put up in that form and in that way had this been known, but it wasn't known. To this day, he despises Andy Anderson. I mean, his level of venom for Anderson is higher than it is for Wharton. Wharton, I understand. I mean, in the sense that he's coming in, he's the head of the system, he's got to get some element of control. He did have this rogue political thing. And if he could get rid of the whole Pond access, to some extent, for Nestor to play the political game behind the scenes, he then would have, he'd be able to spend time on other kinds of things and could end this problem. So from that perspective, I understand what he was doing. The end result was the decision that was then made. A critical issue in it was Newsday editorialized ultimately against Pond, which was, you could go back and find it in the file, but all things considered at this point, it's in the best interest that he step aside so that we can get past this. Judith Moyers, who was the Long Island trustee, and who is not a supporter of research university. She comes out of the populist Texas mold. I have enormous respect for Bill Moyers. I think he's the best at what he does of our own. But Judith was a really interesting character because originally, she, I think, too, was one of the first trustees appointed from Long Island. They didn't have Long Island trustees in the main. There was a great fight to get a Long Island trustee, so they got Moyers appointed. She came by, and she appeared to be very, very supportive, but the problem was her focus was a populist focus on access, not on research or quality. She was looking at the undergraduate missions, not on the and Cliff. She was very much involved in Cliff Wharton's selection, whatever else. She liked Johnny, didn't like Alec. The stiffness of Alec came through. And the end result was she got to Newsday from her old contacts. got them to editorialize right away, and it was over. I mean, at that point, it was like, oh, they then went to Schmidt. You know, Alec, in effect, was fired. Schmidt's first, I am told, authoritatively, I think, that the first thing Wharton said to Schmidt is, now get rid of the mess. I understand that completely. I was due to go back on the second part of my leave, so I went off on the second part of my leave and just never came back. And then it kind of progressed from there. And they went with Jack Marburger.
Schmidt did a good job.
I think he did a very good job. I mean, everything I knew about him. I also thought he was a class act. I mean, in my dealings with him while I was there, I found him very honest, very straightforward, very upfront. He never did ask for my resignation at all. I mean, I took care of that for him. I mean, I understood the moment. But, and if I were Wharton, I probably would have said the same thing to Schmidt before his words. I mean, get rid of this last guy and get to work on this. But it was just a terrible period for the institution. And what was at stake literally was the future. Was it going to be a place that was going to have that comprehensive mission? And even if that had been achieved, even if we had secured agreement on a comprehensive mission, that was only the first fight, because the rest of the fight was making it happen within that crazy system. And having two perspectives. One is having been in Illinois to see how other great public universities work and the differences. It's 180 degrees on a continuum. And now being at Cornell, where I spent a lot of time in Albany because of our land grant status, and understand how, and we have an affiliation with SUNY, although we're separate, obviously, from SUNY, and seeing how it works in New York State, the way Cornell can play it and the way SUNY plays it, and it's nightmare. It's just nightmare. There is no, I mean, I was shocked when I came back to New York to Cornell by two things. One was I picked up this little local newspaper in my first, the Ithaca Times, on my first week here, and I opened it up and there was a letter from Mitch Cohen of the Red Balloon Collective, and I said, my God, he's following me around. The other was that with one exception, every single actor in SUNY was exactly the same. And to this day, they're all the same.
Wait a minute.
All the senior people in SUNY are still there from when I left. When I came, you look at your various, I mean, with limited exception. I mean, there have been, obviously been some people who moved and the chancellors have changed. But the guy who's now replaced Oscar Lanford as the head of facilities, I mean, even that was another one. Oscar Lanford had wanted to be president of Stony Brook.
Sure,
desperately.
I know that.
Oscar Lanford was head of the construction fund. Oscar Lanford hated Johnny Joel with a passion. Oscar Lanford worked the trustees like crazy against Toll. I mean, as an ongoing kind of thing. So Lanford gets replaced. He's replaced by Irv Friedman, who had been another vice chancellor. He'd been their legislative guy. He's a good guy and all that. But that's one character. I mean, you go through their present vice chancellors. They all were there. They all were vice chancellors in other jobs. I mean, they just move them all around, but the point is you've got the same people for 15 years, and this is, the issues are the same, the mentalities are the same. This is a bureaucracy. This is a state bureaucracy. And Stony Brook is paying the price for that. Now, even, as I said, even if the battle had been won, the crucial battle had been won, then came the real hard work, which is working through the system and developing the kind of infrastructure for governance at the campus that made sense in everything.
Do you know anything about Marburger?
I hear lots of things. The difficulty I have with it is I think people, as I are inclined to believe that I don't want to believe good things about him, so they phrase their things to me in such a way as to imply that. In other words, I mean, Marburger was the one who replaced Pond. I was associated with Alex, so people are very careful what they say to me about Jack Marburger, and will stress the negative, not the positive, let me put it that way. So I know about him. Off the limited times I've seen him, I will say I'm not that impressed with what it's worth. But he may have been what was needed for an interim period. I'm not sure.
I think there's something to that.
I think for an interim period, it's too long. And those whose judgments I would give some credence to don't have a higher organic form. But I, again, I'm always a little worried because I think sometimes people tell me what they think I want to hear rather than what maybe. I'd be curious as to your opinion. You can turn that off on that if you
want to.
Oh, okay. From the person, I mean, it was an interesting thing about Johnny. We've talked a little bit, either on tape or off, about the issue of the sciences and the non-sciences. If you looked at all the people directly around Johnny on his staff, not one was a scientist. You had Sheldon Ackley, philosopher, ACLU.
From me.
Understood. But philosopher, ACLU, orientation, 10 years head of ACLU. Steve Seidman, Norman Thomas's personal secretary for whatever number of years. I was a government major, liberal arts orientation, not a scientist. David Dixon in English. I mean, you go through the list. Jeremy, everybody around Johnny was not a scientist. I think it was intentional on his part.
I think it was.
Yes. I think, I say that only because when you saw all of them that way, it couldn't be by accident. I mean, I may be wrong here, but because he did want contrary views. I think people, I don't know that Johnny was a good listener. And I have to say that. I mean, he was a person with very strong opinion. He was very rational. He would get to the point. He saw that goal and wanted to look at it. I'm not sure he was a good listener. But I think he consciously picked people to be around him who were not of the same views as he was to make sure he was getting different kinds of views. Part of the problem was that after enough times where the decision ends up being contrary to the advice you get from that group, they give up on giving the advice to some extent. That was one thing. I mean, I think to Johnny's favor, he made that kind of a judgment. The second thing was that he was my mentor in a way that no one else has been. And I learned an extraordinary amount from him and learned it in a way that by the time I left that place in my early 30s, I knew a whole lot more about managing large, complex universities and developing different kinds of things because he gave me enormous running room. I mean, he was the kind of mentor who would let you make mistakes, which is what seems to me is very important. He knew I would never do anything intentionally to screw up, I think. Mm-hmm. But he really gave me just a huge range to run in. I mean, the whole political area, I mean, a lot of these other kinds of things. And I think he made a judgment early on that he would, I mean, he liked people who took initiative. He liked all of it. To me, one of the shockers when I got there were so many vacuums that needed to be filled. I mean, the absence of the infrastructure, whatever. But I just saw a problem and thought it was interesting and would go work on it. Others could have done that and didn't. And I've thought about that often, and I think there are two reasons. I was never a threat to him in any way.
All right, let me stop right there. Yeah. One of the things that I think was to his credit, he succeeded me.
Yeah.
I had gone down to interview him, and one of his first questions was, why don't you want the job? Mm-hmm. Or don't you want the job? Mm-hmm. And I told him that I did not, for various reasons. And after he was appointed, or even before, we had talked, and our understanding was that I would stay on for a year.
Mm-hmm.
We would see how we got along. Ordinarily, a man coming in new doesn't want his predecessor around him anywhere in the vicinity.
Right,
Apparently, Johnny didn't feel threatened by me, at least. And there was never any question at the end of the year that I would stay on.
Right.
And he raised my salary.
Yeah, yeah.
I took a cut to stay.
Mm-hmm.
I could have gone back to Albany.
Yeah.
Sam Gould asked me
mm-hmm.
if I was interested in doing that.
Mm-hmm.
Van and I had been on Long Island
mm-hmm.
previously. Had friends there. It was fairly close to her home,
yeah.
Providence, so. And
made sense to stay.
Made yeah. sense to stay.
Well, the, when I say not a threat, I think the point I mean by that is, I've seen, just as an anecdote, when I was being interviewed in Illinois, their chancellor had been dean of their law school for 13 or 14 years, a venerable person at the campus. The president was new, was from outside the university, was 15 years younger than he. And I asked him, because of my own interest in this relationship question between the power of the campus head and the system head of these multi-campus, how do you guys deal with the fact that the president of your system is right across the street from you? In fact, the president of the system's office at Urbana is on the quad. The chancellor of the campus's office is two blocks off the quad, which is a very interesting issue. And he said, well, you know, we agree, I'd say 90-95% of the time on most things. When we don't, we go behind a closed door and can really battle it out. So, on the other hand, I'm much older than he is and I'm not much of a threat. That was a very telling comment, because one of the things that came through in my research was that to the extent that the system head looks at the campus head as someone interested in his or her job, it may very well color the nature of that relationship in a perfectly understandable way. When I say that Johnny didn't see me as a threat in any way,
you know whether anybody at Oyster Bay took part in the planning of the campus out here? Was anybody responsible for the location of the buildings?
No, I was certainly heavily involved in the planning of the first engineering building and consulted on some of the general buildings like the library and so on, but the site plan when I got here was already arranged. That is, the engineering building was here and the library was there. So that took place before I came.
And chemistry chemistry and biology were the closest to the library.
Yes. But of course the first year we had no library.
Right.
We had the humanities building, the chemistry building, and I'm not sure about the biology building, probably.
No, it came in
during the year, maybe. Set up the library in the humanities building.
Yeah, right.
And many of us were in chemistry. Engineering was in chemistry. Chemistry was in chemistry. Probably physics was in chemistry.
My office was in humanities.
Your office was in humanities, right? Mine was in chemistry. And then the second year, I think, we began.
And we had G-Quad.
Yes, right. Oh, those were strange days, Carl.
Yeah. We went through a period when every building was a multi-purpose building.
Yes.
We had to do it.
Even the new engineering buildings. We had part of music in there at one time. Those bongo drums drove us crazy. Yeah,
right.
Okay,
right.
Well, let's see. Well, I was sort of fooling around with question 10.
Right.
Why do you think I was appointed? Well, I'm not sure why I was appointed, because I had an engineering background. What expectations did you have when you came? Well, the expectations academically of being involved in developing a new curriculum for engineering, as I mentioned before.
Right.
How these expectations worked out, both personally and for the institution? Not very well, I don't think. If you look at the organization of the college today and the curriculum, we're pretty much back to what it was before we tried to change it.
Okay.
That is, the departments have now become professional departments again. We have mechanical engineering, electrical engineering.
Why is that, you know?
Yeah. Yes, I think I know. There are a variety of reasons. One of them was tradition. It was very difficult for the parents to understand if their son wanted to be a mechanical engineer, why he studied in a department of thermal sciences and fluid mechanics. The loss of the professional names, which are identified in the public's mind, was difficult,
yeah,
from a recruiting standpoint. It was very difficult to change the bureaucratic structure of the recognition of the former organization. For example, the New York State Civil Service, even though we were the state university, would not give our students credit for graduating from an approved curriculum because we did not have a civil engineering department, for example. So if one of our students wanted to go to work in the highway department, he was not recognized as having a legitimate degree because he didn't have a civil engineering degree. And also it was from the fact that as we got more and more faculty, all of who came from schools which had the former organization, they wanted to keep the same organization. And so sort of one by one, the departments voted to go back to their original names and purposes as being undergraduate departments.
Did the concept of, the original concept of engineering science as a fundamental floor of knowledge for all of the separate engineering departments last at all?
Oh yes, that certainly lasted. That is, if you compare our curriculum to the curriculum before World War II, for example, There's just no comparison. That is, our present-day students have so much more of the basic sciences of physics and chemistry and even biology nowadays and mathematics that there is no comparison at all. So that part stuck.
Good.
That is, the engineering curriculum was heavily strengthened in science and mathematics.
Okay. How about your placement of students and your attracting of students? Engineering and some of the other disciplines go through cycles, apparently.
Yes, some severe cycles. We're on a downward cycle right now.
You are?
Yes, so I'm told. We were on an upward cycle for a number of years. They seem to have a period of about 10 years or something like that. And they go up for 10 years and they go down for 10 years. I don't understand.
Does it follow at all the breakthroughs in the frontiers of the basic sciences? Does engineering, the use by engineers of the new knowledge?
I don't know whether the total number of students does. The way the students, the areas in which the students choose to study certainly does. I mean, because of the solid state revolution, and there are so many students in electrical engineering, and because of the computer business, there are many students in computing sciences and so on. I think the cycle is partially demographic and partially socially driven. Everybody's going to suffer right now because the number of students available is. We're going into a depression, but that's a demographic problem, which we have no control over. And especially in the last 20 years, there have been times when science, but even more technology, I think, has been identified in many people's minds with bad things. Weapons of destruction, and environmental problems, and so on. So. I think that was true in the 60s, particularly, where there was a sort of a national revolt because of the Vietnam War and so on. And I think we suffer sometimes from that problem, and in my view, probably rightly so. That's how the expectations worked and what was the history of what happened, I think. Were my activities confined to the Stony Brook campus, or did you have relations outside? You mean professional relations?
Yes, professional relations, or even administrative. Did you deal directly with anybody in Albany?
No.
Dean of Engineering, was
no,
there anybody in Albany?
Generally not, except I would go along in the budget hearings, but I reported to originally the president, and then when it became an academic vice president or a provost, I reported to them. So no, I didn't deal directly with the central office in Albany. I had a lot of outside activities, as you know. I'm very internationally minded.
Yes, right. I know.
And have a lot of professional activities outside the campus.
But in the central office, there was no particular individual with an engineering training to whom you could go.
No. No way.
What understanding of engineering was there in the Bureau of the Budget?
I don't think very much.
Axelrod and Billette and Norm Hurd. Norm Hurd was in the Department of Agriculture before he became
director of the budget.
Yeah.
Is that what he was? I never had any dealings with Norm Hurd. He maybe have blown through a couple of the budget hearings up there, but it was with the people that reported to Hurd that we talked to, I believe. No, there was nobody really up there, and that presented some difficulty because engineering, like every other discipline, has their own problems.
Sure, right.
And they're unique, and it was difficult to convince people of it, I think.
Do you know whether Buffalo came in with engineering about the same time we did?
Yes, I think early in my tenure here was when Buffalo came in.
Started?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe roughly about the same time.
I see.
Because I remember getting together with the Dean of Engineering in Buffalo, saying welcome to the club, and trying to establish some relationships with them.
Right. Did they started off in a different way, did they?
Well, of course, they were an old school, and they've had engineering for a long, long time.
Oh, they have?
Oh, yes.
They
came in as an engineering college, and a rather large one.
I see.
They were in some trouble. I think they had lost their accreditation, mostly because of financial difficulties. And so they had their own set of problems, and of course they've taken care of quite well. Buffalo Engineering School is a very reputable one now.
Was there any help for engineering on the part of Harriman or Rockefeller?
No. Harriman was for my time, really.
I see.
Rockefeller clearly was a friend of State University, more so than subsequent governors, especially the present one.
Yes.
I don't think he differentiated. I think it was the concept of the State University which he was more interested in.
Did we have any contact with Farmingdale?
Excuse me. Well, engineering did, because Farmingdale had a two-year program in engineering science, which was designed as a transfer program, and of course we were one of the obvious places to transfer to.
Did you get students from Farmingdale?
One of the things I did when I first came as dean was to make contacts with not only Farmingdale, but with Nassau Community College and Suffolk Community College. Those are the three in the area, and all three had engineering science two-year programs. Mm-hmm. And we set up transfer arrangements so that if a student would take the two-year program in any one of these three institutions, it was sort of an automatic transfer. And we tried to coordinate the courses as well as we could with having two different faculties. I must say we got very good students from all three of those institutions. What they did was bend over backwards to keep the standards in those programs enormously high so that their students would do well when they graduated, and we found that they were every bit as good, in some cases better than our own students. So it worked out very well, I think, and continues to do so.
Did you do any active recruiting from upstate, in upstate New York?
Well, I went and gave a few talks. As you know, in those days, unlike today, the recruiting and admission was entirely out of the hands of the engineering college. It was in the hands of the admissions
right.
group.
Right.
And they did the recruiting, and they decided who were admitted with some input, but almost none from us, anyhow. And so whenever I was invited by them to give a talk or anything, I certainly would, and I did, you know. But it was on a sort of a hit-and-miss basis. It was not something that we organized.
I see. Okay.
So that's about it, I guess. 13 questions, that's an unlucky number.
Well, there's someone on the other side.
Oh, really?
A couple, yes. Just to get away from the 13.
Oh, okay. What do you feel you had accomplished at Stony Brook by 1971? Well, that was when I finally decided I'd been dean long enough. I think 10 years in a position like that is plenty. One of the things I did find when I was looking through my files this morning was my resignation letter to the faculty written in 1971, telling them why I was leaving.
Well, send a copy of that to Abert Folkers.
Okay, I'll do that. Oh, I felt that what we had accomplished is we certainly had a viable engineering college by 1971. We had You know, we had established 5 PhD programs in all of the departments so that our research was growing. We were recognized entity nationally. Mm-hmm. We suddenly began to appear in the lists and so on. And we had some pretty rocky years in the 60s, but that came about because of the university as well as the engineering college. But I felt that we had gotten started and we had done a pretty good job for 10 years, but then how could I feel anything other than that and live with myself? Can you name individuals who did things that were important for the future development of the university as a whole or some part of it?
That's taking a...
You mean in my area?
A broad institutional view. In other words, from your point of view.
Well, going back to the very beginning, I think those individuals that gave us some leadership in our transition from that terrible time in 1961 when the campus was all split up and then where we had to come back together again, I think you and Harry Porter had certainly an important part in that.
Harry was, I thought at that point, was a very useful person. He took responsibility for some of the personnel problems that went back into the Oyster Bay days that I knew nothing about.
Mm.
And he apparently had the background and was willing to take the leadership on the Martin question, for instance.
Oh, yes.
And who was head of mathematics?
Well, Bill Lister was, but then they brought in another guy that is under John Lee, and I forget his name, but
yeah,
there was a lot of problems with that appointment.
Right.
Well, I'm reminded just while we talk about Harry Porter, just after John Lee was fired, I guess it was a day or so afterwards, I got a call from Tom Hamilton, the chancellor in Albany, and he said I have to do something, he said, to fill the leadership gap down there. The place is just sort of a boiling cauldron. And he said, I'm inclined on the recommendation of a group of the faculty to appoint the following person as acting president. And you don't need to know the name of the person. But I told him that that person was identified, was very strongly with one of the groups. And if he did that, it was going to be murder down here. And I suggested that he bring somebody in from the outside. And I had known Harry Porter because he had come down, he was provost, and
yeah,
he had come down to the university a number of times. And I said, I think a very good guy would be Harry Porter to come down here because he has that kind of a personality and he's divorced from the immediate problems down here, and I think he can get along with both groups and do something. So I don't know how many other people recommended Harry Porter, but at least I did to Hamilton, and he did appoint him very shortly thereafter, and I think he was a good appointment.
Yeah.
I think anybody from the campus would have been a catastrophe,
yeah. Right.
Including me.
How do you think my 3 years worked out?
I think they worked out very well. Those were building years, mm-hmm, as you know. We had our series of problems, but it seems to me we had a fairly good group. I'm reminded of Stan Ross, who is no longer with us, but who I think was a very good appointment. I think that was your appointment.
Yes.
As Dean of the Arts and Science College.
You remember driving somewhere with me, am I asking you about Stan Ross?
Yeah, we were driving to Yale, as a matter of fact.
Is that right?
To talk about another faculty problem.
I think
you remember. Yes, well, you asked me about several people.
Yeah.
And I told you what I thought. you know, on the Long Island Expressway. Mm-hmm.
Well, I had liked the way he handled the paper and the appointment searches in the history department.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought he was after good quality.
Yeah, I think he was. Yeah.
Now, as it turned out, he had a fairly sharp focus on Latin America.
Yes.
And I don't know.
Well, he went down to head up a Latin American institute at Texas, didn't
yes,
he?
Yes, right. Mm-hmm. I saw him one time. He was walking with a cane.
Really?
I looked, bent over him.
Because I only remember him as a very active guy.
I know.
We got along. He and I got along very well together.
Yeah. Well, I think almost anybody could get along with you.
Well, I'm not so sure about that. You check that out with Olga. Well, that's about it, huh?
Yeah.
Better turn it off for...
Okay.